Hi and welcome back. This is episode number 300. Can you believe it? So today we are talking to Greg Wyatt. We've got him back on the show. He is the Director of Business Intelligence at PSA Philippines Consultancy. They are a risk consulting firm. They release a regular newsletter that is just a wealth of information for all things economic, business, and risk oriented for the Philippines. I really recommend people check it out if you're based in the Philippines or you have business interests in the Philippines. Greg Wyatt is an absolute fountain of knowledge, so it was great to get him back on the show. We actually spoke to Greg 4 months ago to the day, so it's good timing to get him back, and we review the last 4 months. Mainly, obviously, in reference to the coronavirus and how we are progressing with that. I had a great conversation with Greg. I learned a lot, and I'm sure you will too. Enjoy. If you want any of the show notes, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. Greg Wyatt, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm interested to hear what you have to say too.
It's going to be a good conversation. Greg, I want to start. We actually had our last conversation on this podcast 4 months ago to the day, and a lot has happened in those 4 months. You involve yourself. I'll get you to explain what PSA Consultancy is, but can you give us the overview of what you think has changed in the last 4 months in terms of COVID and in terms of just economic situation for the Philippines?
Right. So, you know, I think that the context that's important is Philippines had really one of the longest, strictest lockdowns in the world. Some people say it was the longest, right? So we went through over 100 days of pretty strict restrictions here in Metro Manila, but we never drove cases down to zero the way that some other countries had. And then through June and through July, the government opened up. They want to get the economy moving again. Cases exploded towards the end of July. So we're running several thousand cases per day. The government didn't want to put more restrictions in place, but their hand was kind of forced politically by some very public statements from the medical and the healthcare community. And so we just finished another 2 weeks of elevated restrictions, and we still have several thousand cases per day now largely centered around Metro Manila. We're going into the next phase where today is the first day where restrictions have been lighter.
And to put that, you know, a few numbers and a little bit of context, when we spoke 4 months ago, there were about 22,000 cases in the Philippines. Right. Now there's about 175,000 cases, I believe. And, you know, as you say, we're in theory coming out of the longest, strictest lockdown globally. And yet, you know, despite those measures, recent new cases were up to 5,000-6,000 a day. And we've now just come out of a sort of 2 week period of stronger lockdowns back into the eased level of lockdowns. What do you think about the plan to date and the trajectory and the prognosis for the management of this pandemic?
Yeah, so it is unfortunate given the extent of the lockdowns that they weren't able to drive the cases to zero the way, you know, Vietnam has, or the way that New Zealand, Taiwan, some other countries have done. There's a few reasons for that. I think number one is, in some ways, that the challenge the Philippines faces is more difficult, right? So like from the very beginning, people have been saying that, for a lot of people that live in Metro Manila, it's very difficult to self-isolate, right? So if you live in an informal community, maybe you share a toilet with your neighbors, you live in a household that has a lot of people in it. And I think one of the things that we've seen is that initially, a lot of the positive cases that were being reported were kind of in the upper class, people that were traveling internationally and things like that. Then very quickly, it started to become more of a disease that it affected healthcare workers, but also certain vulnerable communities were hit very hard. So people living in informal communities have been hit very hard, and the prison system has been hit very hard in particular, something you see in a lot of other countries as well. I think that's one of the reasons why the situation wasn't fully gotten under control and contained the way it was in some other places. And then also, you know, the other side is the public health interventions side of things. So testing did not increase maybe as fast as it could. The contact tracing system has not been very effective here. There's a new contact tracing czar who's very open about that, which is a good start, identifying why contact tracing has not been very effective within Metro Manila and what the problems are. So if you look at the public health side of things, you're really looking at three pillars of how you combat the virus. And it's testing, isolation, and contact tracing. The Philippines is testing a lot of people right now, so like say 30,000 people per day, but relative to the number of cases we have, the positivity rate is pretty high. So I think the 14-day average as of today is sitting somewhere at like 12%. There's not enough testing for the amount of infections that there is. The contact tracing system, particularly in Metro Manila, needs to be improved. I think on the good end, the government has been very open about, in recent weeks, understanding why it wasn't working and what the problems are and where they want to go. Isolation's been okay once people get tested. So if you can't afford to really properly self-isolate, the local government is supposed to do an assessment of whether you have the capacity to self-isolate or not. You know, if you're living on your own in a condo, you can stay in your condo. But if you live with a big family and vulnerable people and stuff like that, they're supposed to get you out and take you to a quarantine center where you can finish your mild or asymptomatic case.
In terms of the economic situation, then I feel that the government has always been leaning, you know, over the last few months towards safety first, health first. And, you know, trying to quash the disease. And now I think they've sort of turned a corner and they're saying, look, the disease is here and we've had as much time out as we can now tolerate. We have to get the economy moving again. So I think they're sort of trying to you know, tread a very delicate path in not having an explosion in numbers yet, trying to open up the economy again. In terms of a business context, you know, I think the economy in the Philippines is devastated. The shopping malls are pretty much closed. No one is out shopping. No one is out eating. And most businesses are closed. One of the shining lights of the economy, of course, is the outsourcing sector that, you know, by its nature is serving overseas and foreign businesses. And as long as those businesses in different countries are still active, still working, then I think it's providing a very strong economic anchor to the Philippines. However, you know, it's hard for the BPOs to do the work they need to do when there are the restrictions in place, the travel restrictions, and the sort of health guidance and things like that. What are your thoughts in terms of, I suppose, the general economy? And then how the BPO and outsourcing economy is responding?
Right. So, you know, I think you're right that is the way that the government is thinking, that they tried very hard to contain the virus, to get to a situation where they'd be at near zero cases. It didn't work. And that now they're really against another lockdown. I think their hand was kind of forced by these very public statements from the healthcare industry that they were getting overwhelmed. I think we may be in some kind of similar situation again if the healthcare system is saying we're overwhelmed, or if the general public feels that they're overwhelmed with cases. But the government does not have the will for another lockdown. They've made that pretty clear. I do feel a little bit that it's kind of a false choice between health and the economy, right? So the countries that have been doing the best are the ones that got the virus under control. You know, Vietnam, Taiwan, South Korea, Malaysia's doing okay, Thailand's doing okay. So I don't think there is a good example of a country where this has really gotten out of control that's doing well economically. The United States is hurting, Brazil is hurting. Maybe the best case would be Sweden, something like that. But even Sweden's hurting economically, right? But I don't think there's an example that we can look to of a country that decided to preserve the economy over health. That really what it is that the number of cases that you have, that the state of infection will dictate what's happening economically. That you can't have a normal economy if the hospitals can't accept people anymore, things like that.
I'm personally concerned about the resilience of economies. And of course, in developing nations, there's less resilience in economies because, there's just less fat. And my concern is that, you can sort of cut away, but then eventually you begin a sort of deflationary spiral. There's going to be more unemployment, so there's going to be less consumer spending, and so on, more businesses shut down, and you begin this cycle of just economic destruction that potentially couldn't be halted. And it doesn't sound like the Philippine government has a lot of sort of stimulus packages or programs. So I'm really concerned about the viability of the Philippine economy if they continue a sort of process of lockdown.
Right. Yeah. So there is not a large stimulus underway at all. Right. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. I think the economic team is pretty fiscally conservative. So over the first 4 years, they've done a really good job of building up government revenues relative to spending and things like that. And they're really proud of their credit rating, their debt to GDP ratio, things like that. And they have certain targets that they don't want to break. I think there is potentially an argument there where maybe some economists feel that the government has more room to maneuver than they say. But I'm not an economist, so I'm not going to put too much of my two cents into that. In terms of the suffering, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's pretty clear that people are suffering pretty badly. With a poorer economy, you have fewer people working from home, so you have less resiliency there. Also, I think one of the things that's underappreciated that's a huge part of Filipino life is malnutrition, right? So, even under the best of times, there is a certain percentage of the population that grows up malnourished, right? And I don't think you can understate the lifelong impacts of growing up malnourished. For the rest of people's lives, they will suffer physically and developmentally from the consequences of growing up malnourished. So yeah, and it's pretty clear that people are hungry. Under normal economic circumstances, there's a certain percentage of the population of people that are hungry, and that's just grown. And Philippines could feel the consequences of that for a long time. So,
do they have full visibility, or should I say, do they have full transparency on that impact in the Philippines in terms of the rise in numbers of malnutrition?
Yeah, my best source on that would be the social weather stations. So Social Weather Station has done a couple polls on the impact of not malnutrition, but are people hungry? They call it a hunger survey. And certainly the numbers have gone way up, absolutely. And that's really one of the things that the administration has been really proud of for the first 4 years, is how that number went down over the first 4 years since 2016. And it's, it goes back before that as well, of course. It is unfortunate to see how people are suffering in that regard.
Greg, go ahead. Give us a little bit of context. Can you just explain what you do? You're the director of business intelligence. You work with PSA consultancy. What is PSA?
Yeah, so we're a business risk consultancy, right? So we help our clients operate in risky environments in Southeast Asia, particularly in the Philippines. And so we have different service lines, but mostly what I do is I run a subscription reporting service. So we put out reports about natural disasters. We put out a lot of reports about COVID. We've basically been doing a report every day. We do reports on crime, insurgency, things like that. So the Philippines is a pretty interesting place to do that kind of work because the security situation is pretty complex. It varies tremendously, even within different neighborhoods in Metro Manila. But then once you start to compare Metro Manila to Mindanao and things like that, there's a lot of very localized issues. But yeah, the business risk consultancy industry, generally in terms of where we sit in the industry, I tell people that there's a lot of risk consultants in the financial centers of the world, right? So Hong Kong, Singapore, New York, London, but there's not many risk consultants on the ground in the Philippines. So that's really where our competitive advantage is, that we're used to working with international clients and working to the international standards, but we have the advantage that we're on the ground here in the Philippines.
And I suppose in your line of business, a steady, stable day, there's not a lot to report. So, you know, you must be having a field day at the moment with COVID, with the economic upsets, with the earthquakes and volcanoes all happening right at the moment.
Yeah, we've been pretty busy in 2020. You know, for example, one of the service lines for the subscription reporting is a special advisory. And, you know, maybe we did 100 special advisories in 2019. And between earthquakes and COVID, we've basically been doing one every day. Our volcanoes, that was the other one. We put out a lot of reporting about the volcano. I don't know if having a field day is the right thing. You know, there's a lot of demand for our services, but a lot of our clients have trouble paying us right now. Right, there's not a lot of liquidity to go around for new services and things like that. So,
sure. And so, Greg, just to bring it back around to the business context and outsourcing, and you know, what have you seen from this particular sector? Have you seen any major trends in terms of outsourcing, in terms of fulfillment, in terms of employment for this sector in the Philippines?
Yeah, so I do think normally the best source of information on this is IBPAP, right? The BPO Industry Association. And I think that they've been pretty quiet about doing things like projections or putting out assessments of how strongly the industry has been affected. So, you know, if they were putting out more information, I would immediately defer to whatever they were doing. But in terms of what I can see, I've seen a lot of companies that in the shared service industry. So BPOs that are part of one company and only service that company with a back office support in a lot of different ways. I know several companies in that category that have expanded over the course of this crisis and the lockdowns and things like that. On the bad side, those companies are smaller, right? So those operations are smaller, I should say. So, you know, maybe they have 700 people in the Philippines, or they've gone from 300 to 700 since April, or, 600 to 1,000, something like that. But I think that the companies that it's been harder for are those in the voice industry that have multiple clients, third-party providers for multiple clients. And you could, I think the reason there is that, Philippines, one of the main competitive advantages for the Philippines in the BPO industry is voice, right? So you have a developing country, but that speaks English very well. People are very hospitable. They're wonderful to interact with. They have a good hospitality culture and all those other things that make voice better for the BPO industry here than really anywhere else in the world. But voice in a work-from-home environment doesn't work as well. I think some of the minor considerations are just background noise and things like that. A lot of people live with big families. Maybe they live in the countryside. There's a lot of anecdotal stories that you read about chickens in the background and stuff like that when people call up customer service. But I think the more serious concerns are security, right? So right. There's a threat that people don't talk about a lot, which is the theft of data. And it's not a cyber threat per se. It's a kind of brute force, unsophisticated threat of stealing personally identifiable information and selling it for very small amounts, one piece at a time. And so in an office environment, really, if that's the kind of work that you do, say for voice or multiple clients in the financial industry, you have a lot of controls in place. You're monitoring the way people go to the bathroom and stuff like that through CCTV cameras. But it's just not compatible with work from home, those kinds of controls. So my sense is that, yeah, unfortunately, I think voice has been hit harder. It's a shame because Philippines' real competitive advantage is voice. And I think probably what you would find is the companies that have been hit the hardest are those that have multiple clients in the financial industry that handle sensitive information, like accounting, things like that.
I tend to agree. I think the, you know, and as you say, the smaller BPOs are proliferating at the moment. They seem to be doing well. And, you know, I think this next 10 years is the time for the smaller SME facing BPOs to really shine. I think the bigger enterprise BPOs were plateauing anyway. And, you know, they were the type that would handle, as you say, the high security accounts, the old school call center accounts. And I think they have really been impacted by the work from home transition and the viability of doing those high security jobs from anywhere other than the office. So I completely agree with you. And I'm not quite sure how the industry will restructure the new normal, and in terms of having a hybrid home and office environment, because it doesn't seem like there's any light at the end of the tunnel or any let up from or certainly going back to a normal work environment.
Yeah, I think this has kind of accelerated a lot of the trends that were happening before. So if you go back to some of the reports or statements from IBPAP in like 2016, 2017, there are certain industries that they talk about that they view as growing or having a lot of potential, like the gaming industry, right? You know, gaming industry is one that has expanded in the Philippines, as far as I can tell. Certain like really high skilled BPO work, right? You know, I know of a client or a BPO that they do a lot of really like sophisticated medical advisory and stuff like that. You know, a lot of their employees here in the Philippines are doctors and nurses. Mm. And they're not just processing insurance claims, they're actually working with patients remotely. And they've grown, right? So I think what we've seen is that a lot of the really high-skilled work, particularly if it's just for one client, has grown even. But then like the big call centers, particularly if they're doing something sensitive with customer information and things like that, have been hit the hardest. You know, I don't have hard numbers to back that up, but that would be my sense.
So as we evolve into the new normal, as you know, we ease into a sort of reduced lockdown and hopefully people are getting back to work, the government has come out with a joint memorandum between the Department of Labor and the Department of Trade and Industry, which provides guidance for employers about how to treat employees, how to test employees, you know, and general standards. It's a little bit of a concern, I feel, because it seems, in essence, that all of the costs, all of the burden are being put onto the employers, whereas it seems in most developed countries, it's the employers that are getting assistance from the government. What's your take on the joint memorandum and its content? This podcast is brought to you by Outsource Accelerator. We are the world's leading outsourcing marketplace and advisory. We help big and small businesses with their outsourcing needs, and we can help you too. We cover everything from business and staffing strategy, optimal outsourcing structures, implementations, and fully managed services. If you're already outsourcing, about to start, or somewhere in between, then we can ensure that you get the best from outsourcing. That's the best prices, best terms, and of course, the best results from your outsourcing practices. We list over 700 outsourcing suppliers on our website, host this leading outsourcing podcast, and have over 5,000 pages of content. Because we span the entire market, we can ensure that you get the best deal possible. We offer everything from light brokerage, co-managed services, through to fully managed solutions. Get in touch today. Visit us at outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. Mention that you're a podcast listener and we will give you special attention plus a 10% discount. This is for a limited time only. Go to outsourceaccelerator.com/quote.
Yeah, so the one that we're talking about is Joint Memorandum 2004, which came out on Friday. The first point that I would make, and this has been emphasized a lot in the discussions that I've had with different people, is that a lot of those requirements, if you look at the wording, they're not mandatory, right? So it talks about some kind of ideal that you, like, you provide mental health care for all of your employees, but there's an easy out in that you can just provide them the national mental health care hotline if you can't afford to provide them real, like, counseling sessions and things like that. I think the shuttles that it mentions that they're recommended, they're not mandatory. So I think, like, the first thing is everybody's got to read it really closely. And I think a lot of the news coverage has not done a good job of this, about pointing out what is mandatory and what's just recommended. So, for example, another kind of in response to this, another memorandum came out, 2001, and I'm not sure why it's 2001 comes out after 2004, but 2001 clarifies that the kind of testing that it talks about in 2004 is optional, right? So it's something that if you're in particular industries, if you can pay for it, now you can do this kind of asymptomatic PCR screening and testing. I think that's the first point is understand a lot of what they're talking about is optional. And then I think also, like, there is some pushback against some of the more stringent requirements. Like, for example, the idea that one of the potentially the most burdensome aspect is this idea that buildings have to shut down for 24 hours when an employee has a positive case. And we'll see in a week's time if that's still part of the regulations, for example.
The entire building or just the office related to that employee?
It says building. It refers to building in 2001 or 2004, sorry. Yeah.
Right. And this is the problem. I mean, the devil's in the detail, isn't it? And, you know, the government has been very supportive of the outsourcing industry. It's always been exempted from lockdown. BPO workers or outsourcing employees have been seen as essential staff. So the government is really aware of the importance of the industry and trying to support it. But if general guidelines become too arduous, you know, and with offices requiring social distancing and require shutting down if ever there's a confirmed case or even a suspected case, then, you know, it just becomes too arduous to really run an operation. And I think that's where you get into this awkward gray zone of, you know, sure, you're allowed to operate, the doors are open, but just the limitations on process are too great.
Yeah.
And it makes the whole business unviable.
Well, yeah, and unfortunately, another aspect is the question of enforcement, right? So, a lot of regulations in the Philippines are very well designed, but then there's just not the capacity for enforcement. And so then companies end up asking a lot of questions about, you know, what should we really focus on? So, enforcement is going to be a tricky issue for all these things. I do try to be optimistic, and I guess my point of optimism right now is that that potentially the Philippines may still get it right in terms of getting to the right mix of controls and the right mix of restrictions that will keep the transmission of the virus down, right? In the epidemiological terms, you know, it's the R-naught value, right? Get it down to where people are only infecting one other person or less. And It's this is what some of the articles that have been out, and you hear about the hammer and the dance. We're really in the dance right now. We're trying to find the right mix of policies that allow the country to and the Metro Manila region to control the spread of the virus and keep the spread down. And maybe with all these new rules about face shields, all the new restrictions on companies, whatever actually comes out in terms of being the real set of restrictions as we go forward in the next few weeks, maybe you'll get it right. I think there are other points to be positive about. Internationally, testing's getting better. Here in the Philippines, the numbers of tests certainly have grown dramatically from March and the start of the crisis. We're still not testing enough people based upon the positivity rate. But there's a lot of talk about pool testing, for example. That will create a lot of capacity, and that will probably be really appropriate amongst asymptomatic workers. If you do want to do some kind of irregular screening, I think pool testing is likely to work pretty well. And there's some of that being they're experimenting with some pool testing where you put five cases together or 10 cases, run the test with all 10 of them, and then if it's negative, all of those 10 people are cleared. If it's positive, then you got to run the individual tests and figure out who's really sick. That could work really well for screening if you're testing people who are asymptomatic, because the positivity rate will be low.
Yeah, that's a really cool idea, isn't it? So it's kind of a statistical grouping, and then if there's a positive sign, you break it down. That's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, and it'll be cheaper too. So, I think a lot of companies have really wanted to do testing, and that's why we've seen so much antibody testing. But I think that the international consensus is that antibody testing is not really an appropriate way to screen people who are asymptomatic, because it takes the big issue is not necessarily the accuracy, but the time it takes for your body to produce antibodies. When you're doing an antibody test, you're not really testing for the virus. You're testing for the body's response to the virus. And so, but we've there's been millions of antibody tests done in the Philippines. So I think there's plenty of a desire for employers and individuals to do more testing. And either pooled testing or some other kind of antigen testing, maybe, health nursing homes in the United States are doing mass antigen testing, or the saliva test that has gotten a lot of attention in the news. And some of those things are going to create more capacity for screening employees and things like that, and be economical as well.
And Greg, just to put this in context again, I'm absolutely optimistic. I think what we're discussing here is the minutiae and the details of exactly what's going on the ground. If I talk to clients though, or prospective clients of outsourcing, my message generally is that the society's open, and I think we're at full capacity. Everything is back. And we are operating. And, generally, I think the BPO industry has just done an incredible job in terms of adapting and in terms of moving everyone to work from home. And the operations, for all intents and purposes, are, running at full speed, for most requirements, of course. So, yeah, this is we're looking at the details. We're sort of pulling up the kimono here, but generally, I think the industry and the country is coping incredibly well. Greg, one of the trends we're seeing, and again, I think this has been speeded up by COVID, but it was always kind of happening, is the work from home and the move towards remote work. What do you see with that, with the Philippines and in the perspective of COVID?
Yeah, so I really feel that once all this is done, there's going to be more work from home, right? I think a lot of companies have found certain things that work pretty well in terms of work from home. And some of the challenges, the regular day-to-day challenges that Metro Manila had prior to the outbreak, work from home is pretty attractive, right? So I'm thinking about traffic and commuting, right? Everywhere's got traffic, but traffic here is a real burden to businesses in a way that it's not elsewhere, right? So I think that certainly a lot of businesses are going to see certain, you know, aspects of work from home that are pretty attractive. You know, my own personal example, we do a lot more webinars, right? And that's worked really well. And once all this is done, we'll continue to do a lot of webinars. You know, it's very difficult to do face-to-face meetings when you're commuting around Manila and things like that. So webinars work great for us. You know, I think the biggest questions are on the regulatory side, right? So, and you probably know more about this than I do, but there's certain restrictions for PESA companies. I think it's only 5% of their staff. Previously, before the outbreak, only 5% of our staff was allowed to work from home at any one time. And my understanding, there's a lot of lobbying underway to get that number up in a more permanent fashion. But to 30% is the figure that I keep hearing thrown around. So I know the government is also concerned about, particularly with this current administration. You know, it's an administration from the province, from outside of Metro Manila, from Davao, right, in Mindanao, in particular. And the current administration is really concerned about congestion in Manila and the long term sustainability of growth in Manila, and want to grow the provinces. And I think the BPO industry has been concerned about that, because, you know, Metro Manila is such a competitive place for the BPO industry. Really, it's a, you know, one of the best places in the world to have a BPO operation. And so maybe instead of trying to push new BPOs out to the province and things like that, an alternative would be to allow more work from home and combat some of the issues with congestion and things like that by allowing more work from home in the PESA zones.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I think, you know, and as we see all over history, necessity is the mother of innovation. And I think there's been a trend towards remote, but now that it's essential, and, you know, it went from being optional to essential within a few days. And I think, you know, we're seeing technology, we're seeing innovation quickly follow up and fill in the blanks. But I think it's still, the regulation is slow to catch up. And as you say, you know, we have PESA, which is the effectively a kind of BPO association, support association, and they have very strict guidelines in terms of work practices and work standards. And at this stage, they're still not allowing work from home, or certainly a sort of minority of the workforce. So I think that these regulatory bodies have to really catch up, and catch up quickly, because I think all of society, all of industry is doing its best to cope. It's innovating, it's you know, developing technology to build on work from home solutions. So it's just everyone really needs to kind of come along for the ride.
Yeah, I think PESA is a, you know, PESA is also a real advocate for the industries that work within the economic zones. I think, you know, one thing to understand for the context is PESA is really a series of economic zones, special economic zones, but they're not special economic zones that normal people think of, right? Like normally you think of a port or an industrial area, and there are special economic zones like that, but really, for the BPO industry, you're talking about individual buildings that have this as a designation, as a special economic zone, and they're in commercial centers and stuff like that. That's where the work from home restrictions come from, that kind of angle. You're not just talking about a regular office building, you're talking about a special economic zone. But PESA, you know, PESA likes the companies that operate there, they like them to be competitive. So I think I'd be pretty hopeful that PESA is going to change the regulations once all of this is over and allow more work from home. I don't know how much of it is just up to PESA. You know, what other regulators are involved?
And I think this is one of the fundamental issues with the outsourcing industry. For such a long time, a large part of the value proposition was about the physical premises, was about the offices, was about the hardware, where these roles are going to be done, how it's going to be executed, and the physical hardware that gets it done. And Pezza, buys into that as well with the zoning of the physical space. But actually, everything now is moving online into the cloud, and it's more about the IP. It's more about getting the job done as opposed to where it's being done. So I think there needs to be, almost a complete paradigm shift into how you define the workforce, the workplace, and the work being done.
Yeah. Yeah. And then maybe this is a good time to talk about some of the issues that people are encountering in the work from home environment. Because, coming from the risk perspective, it's interesting. Like a lot of the problems have not really been followed, thought a lot about internationally. And I don't really feel like best practice is established for some of the things that people are running into. So, I mean, the obvious one is that really cybersecurity threats have just exploded since the lockdown started, but not just in the Philippines, although there are some indications in the Philippines about the expansion of cybersecurity threats, but internationally as well. Interpol put out a notice on August 3rd about the expansion of cybersecurity threats, an increase in ransomware, which had gone down in recent years. Ransomware spiked once the lockdowns started again. So I think that's the obvious one, is the cybersecurity threats and scams. Some of it's scams, some of it's very sophisticated threats, right? And I think you can see that now that everybody's IT infrastructure is dispersed across hundreds or thousands of locations, it takes a different model to make sure everything's secure. Also there's a lot of cyber threats that are maybe incorrectly tagged as cyber, but are really more social scams that are done remotely, let's say, right? So what you call business email compromise, sending requests for money transfers from emails that look legitimate but are really fraudulent, and then companies make a payment that they don't realize is a fraudulent payment that they never get back. You could see how people fall for that kind of thing a lot easier when they're not working in the office. So, I think part of the solutions for that are going to be technical, and part of it's going to be education. Actually, one interesting point about that, people talk a lot about the need for cybersecurity education. Great, but I think cybersecurity education tends to be pretty boring, right? People get bored looking at presentations and things like that. And I think the gold standard has really become to constantly run simulated attacks from your own IT department against employees, right? With fake phishing attacks, where if they report it to IT, they get congratulated and they get notified that, hey, this was an attempt by your IT department. This was an exercise by your IT department. You successfully identified the phishing attack. Or if you click on the link, you get a warning. This was a simulated attack by your IT department. If this was a real attack, you would have compromised your computer. So
it's ironic, isn't it? It's just the transition. Everything now is moving online. There's probably less robberies. There's probably less abuse in the streets.
Yeah.
But now there's an increase in cyber. Everything is happening online now, isn't it? All the money, all the transactions are happening online. So just the focus is now online.
Yep. Fencing of stolen goods is happening online. That's an interesting area to look at, the way that you have various online marketplaces that have become the way to fence goods that have been stolen from the supply chain in some way. So maybe I guess some of the other, to kind of bring that back to that, is it's interesting how the physical security threats have not expanded, that they've really decreased, right? So the official crime statistics show that not only during the lockdown, but once the lockdown was lifted, the number of crimes reported stayed very low through June. I think there's a lot of anxiety amongst particularly middle-class Philippines, right, about potential physical security threats. I think a lot of that anxiety is kind of misplaced. But there's some potential that if you're going to engage in risky behaviors like walking alone at night, handling money on the street, things like that, you may be more vulnerable, even though the number of those kind of crime incidences are down. It's interesting because I think maybe part of it is obviously that there's fewer targets on the street, there's more police and movement restrictions and things like that. Part of it, I think, also is what people talk about when they talk about Filipino resilience. And for better or for worse, Filipinos respond very well to crises and hardship and just accept it and move along with life. So yeah, I think some of that is cultural, and it's what people are talking about when they say Filipino resilience, that there has not been civil unrest to speak of in the Philippines, and I'm not particularly concerned about civil unrest. We monitor it because that's what consultants do. I think politically, even though there's some people that are unhappy, even then, I think they're really looking to the next elections to make their voice heard, right? And so we haven't seen civil unrest. We haven't seen an explosion of physical threats that some people have been worried about.
I absolutely agree with you, Greg. I think that, for the Philippines being a developing nation, there's a lot of people that have always been on or just above the poverty line. There's a lot of people really struggling out there. And there's a lot of disparity. There's a huge wealth divide in the country. And I just think after 5 months of lockdown, 5 months of being contained in restricted places, 5 months of not earning money, this place could have been, an absolute tinderbox, like just being absolute, riots on the street. And instead, I think, people aren't happy, of course, but people are behaving, people are respecting each other, and generally, this is an incredibly respectful, functional society when, it's been put under an enormous stress test for the last five months. And you just need to look to other more developed countries, and there's riots in the street, and people are afraid. So I really think it's an incredible testament to the Philippines, and as you say, the resilience, but also the nature of the people, that they're not turning on each other.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's resilience, and it's also the fact that there's an election coming up, right? So even the organizations that are really upset, they look at the elections as the place where they're going to make their voice heard in it, and that's pretty healthy for society, right? So what do you want to move on to next?
So, Greg, I think a concern for, a lot of the expats here, people either trying to get in to see their businesses or to get out to reunite with their family or friends, are the travel restrictions. Now, this isn't unique to the Philippines, but again, the Philippines is generally more strict, and more protracted in terms of its restrictions and lockdown generally, and that's absolutely the case with the international travel restrictions. From what I understand, no one is really allowed out, and no one is really allowed in. What's your take on the travel restrictions?
Yeah, so the travel restrictions are strict as they are written. Basically, it's just permanent residents that are allowed in. And there's been some confusion about this. I think that one of the terms thrown around was long-term residents. And then once the Bureau of Immigration got a hold of that, they basically said it's still just permanent residents. So there's been a lot of confusion about that. What I would say is that there's an exemption process. So you can request from the Department of Foreign Affairs an exemption to be allowed to come into the country for some kind of essential or emergency work purposes. And as long as you respect that process and there is a genuine emergency or essential reason why you have to come in to do your work, my understanding is that most companies have been accepted. So typically you would go through PEZA, like we've spoken about, or you'd go through a Chamber of Commerce and ask for them to endorse your request. And then they would take that request to Department of Foreign Affairs And my understanding is a lot of those examples, a lot of those requests are approved. Most of them are, in fact. You can imagine like this picture, the power industry, right? So power industry grows every year. It grows a lot in the Philippines because it's a growing economy and population is growing and things like that. There's certain specific skills that need to at least temporarily come into the Philippines to support the growth of the power industry. You got a pretty strong case for an exemption in that regards. If you're, I think it's similar if you own equity here, or you're, a business owner here in the Philippines and you're ready to come back, I would really encourage people to look into that exemption, particularly through either through PEZA. PEZA has guidelines about this. Actually, that's probably the public place you can go look. You can search for the PEZA advisory on this, or you can go through a chamber of commerce if you're not in a PEZA zone and request an exemption.
No, it's good that people will manage unique cases. I heard today actually that Thailand, which is obviously a close contemporary, I suppose, they have announced that they're not letting in any tourism for until at least 2021. And of course, they have a big tourism economy. I think it's about 10 times bigger than the Philippines in terms of the revenues. So that's a pretty big statement coming from what is a pretty tourist-centric country. And I can only imagine that the Philippines would follow suit at least, if not, many months later. So it's going to take a long time for international travel to properly resume, isn't it?
Yeah, it will. The tourism industry has been hit really hard, and the recovery is probably going to be slow too. So you talk about L-shaped, V-shaped recoveries and things like that. I think the tourism industry, the restaurant industry, those kinds of companies are going to recover very slowly, whereas manufacturing hopefully may recover more quickly.
Greg, thank you so much. Again, it's been incredible insight. Greg, I'm a subscriber to your newsletter. The recent newsletter that I got 1 or 2 days ago was 10,000 words. I'm so impressed by the depth of the authority, the clarity of the information that you're disseminating. It's an incredible publication. I encourage everyone to sign up. And yeah, it's you shouldn't be in the Philippines and not be part of this newsletter. Greg, if anyone wants to reach out to you, know about the newsletter or know more about PSA, how can they do that?
Yeah, you can email me at greg@psaconsultancy.com, or you can visit our website at PSA Philippines Consultancy. Yeah, check us out. Give us a call, send us an email. Yeah, we'd be happy to discuss things with you.
That was Greg Wyatt. He is the Director of Business Intelligence at PSA Philippines Consultancy. If you want any of the show notes, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. And as always, if you want to email us anything, ask us anything, email us at ask@outsourceaccelerator.com. See you next time.